of State versus Najengo. Can we please have appearances of counsel?
Good morning, Your Honor. Assistant Deputy Public Defender Cody T. Mason on behalf of Mr. Najengo.
Barbara Rosenkranz for the state.
Good morning, Your Honors. Jennifer Kamisiak, Deputy Attorney General, appearing on behalf of the Attorney General.
Welcome, counsel. Mr. Mason, please go ahead.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court. I'd like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal if necessary.
That's fine.
Thank you. Your Honors, the question in this case is whether there is any remedy available to individuals who are held in prison for extra time beyond their term of imprisonment and then are released to parole pursuant to the No Early Release Act. In answering that question, at least according to the state, there is no remedy available to those individuals, and their overall terms of custody must be extended, despite the fact that the same defendant, if incarcerated or on non-year parole, would be entitled to credits. According to the state, this is required because near parole is so distinct and distinguishable from incarceration and non-year parole that it is effectively insulated from the double jeopardy protections, and such that the award of prior service credits would be an undeserved windfall to the defendant and would undermine the purposes of MIRA. The problem with these arguments, Your Honors, is that they are not supported either by the constitutional law or the statutory law used to establish both MIRA and non-MIRA parole. And they should be rejected for three main reasons. First, they should be rejected because MIRA parole, just like MIRA incarceration, is merely a component of an overarching custodial sentence, such that too much time spent on either parole or in prison must be credited to ensure that not too much time in custody is served overall. However, and contrary to the state's arguments, the award of credits is not only consistent with the MIRA statute, but is required under the Parole Act and under the timing provisions in federal case law that the state relies upon. And lastly, the award of credits is required to further fundamental fairness and to avoid absurd results, including a situation in which individuals who abide by their parole conditions can end up serving more time in custody than individuals who violate and are returned to prison. Accordingly, this court should reject the state's arguments, reverse the appellate opinion, and remand the matter so that Mr. Najengo can have his prior service credits applied to his remaining term of parole supervision. Now, to begin with, Your Honors, this case can be resolved based on key undisputed principles of double jeopardy. Under the state and federal constitutions, individuals cannot be punished multiple times for the same offense. And to that end, as articulated in North Carolina versus Pierce, individuals must receive credit for any time spent in custody on an old sentence when any new sentence is imposed. So application of these principles, which the state does not dispute, should result in the award of credits in this case, because as I mentioned, NERA incarceration and NERA parole are just part of one overall custodial sentence. As discussed in the commentary and as indicated by this court in State versus Friedman, they collectively set the overall custodial term, whether that is served in parole, in prison, or through a combination of the two. They are moreover both custodial, served under the control of the Department of Corrections, that is throughout imprisonment and then following release. As this court has also recognized, parole and incarceration are legal equivalents, and in other circumstances has found that credit must be awarded for time served on parole toward a prison term. So near incarceration and parole are not separate to the extent that they can be insulated from each other for double jeopardy protection.
Mr. Mason, can I ask you a question about that part of your analysis? It's clear that the United States Supreme Court acknowledges that a legislature can impose bipartite punishment. And it has instructed us to look at legislative intent in determining that is the legislature's purpose. If we look at the legislature's words and intent at the time it was passing NERA, and agree that there was an intent for bipartite punishment here, why should we second guess that determination? Why would that violate due process to treat them as separate forms of punishment imposed at the time of his conviction?
So I think there's two responses to that, Justice Levesque. Yeah, I think the first is that while there was this intent to have individuals serve time on parole, that was sort of the ideal situation. I think everyone, including the defendant, would ideally like to have them released as soon as they hit that 85% and then serve the rest of the time on parole. But ultimately, the legislature was more interested in just having them serve that time in custody. because the award of credits in this case for that extra time does not result in a gift. It does not result in any less time in custody. Rather, it still serves that purpose of supervision and protecting the public because that individual is spending that time in prison instead of parole.
But if Neera's parole piece is not just punishment, but it's also designed by the legislature to ensure that upon release and transition to the community, perpetrators of these violent crimes are strictly supervised for the length of time that the legislature wants, how can we shorten that time period merely, I don't mean merely, but because Mr. Njango happened to spend more time in custody before he moved on to that separate part of the legislative scheme?
Your Honor, I think the best evidence to show that it would not frustrate the legislature's intent is the fact that individuals can already serve that 3 or 5 year term in prison. Like I mentioned, the ideal situation is somebody's on parole, but if they violate, they can be returned to prison and they can be returned to prison for the rest of that term. And although the legislature may have preferred that it be on parole, that framework recognizes that they are just as happy to have them spend it in prison because the interest is more in terms of having that person be supervised and in custody.
Well, my questions are designed to go to whether or not your strongest argument is really a double jeopardy violation as opposed to you're arguing the fairness of the situation. I know that that was your third point, but you seem to be putting all your eggs in the basket of double jeopardy, and I'm questioning whether or not it fits with the bipartite punishment the legislature seems to permit and instructs us to look to legislative intent in upholding such schemes.
And I think that there are significant fairness issues, I think, regarding avoiding that absurd result in which individuals who abide by their parole can have their overall term of custody extended. And I think just fairness considerations, as this court considered in State versus Williams, in which it afforded credit toward an individual's prison sentence for time spent on probation. But the double jeopardy argument is really just part of this. I think that there is also legislative support, particularly through NJSA 30:4-123.65, which sets the overall amount of time that an individual can send can spend in custody or on their term by aggregating the amount of time spent in prison and on parole. Because that is incorporated into NERA, that is part of the parole statute, and the legislature has not created any type of indication or exception to show that it would not apply. And that's really significant because I think that does establish a sort of statutory parallel to the double jeopardy protection, at least for prison and parole, and creates a more clear communication in the legislature that they want these things considered collectively.
Mr. Mason, can I ask you sort of a hypothetical question?
Yes, Your Honor.
During this 5-year supervisory period, assuming the defendant violates it and is in prison, let's say for a year and a half, mm-hmm. he's got a year and a half that he wasn't credited for. I take it you would argue that year and a half would have to be credited to the time that he's about to serve. Are you following me?
I'm sorry, Your Honor. What would the credit have stemmed from?
Well, he served a year and a half that he shouldn't have on his custodial sentence.
Yeah.
So now he's during the 5-year period, he's getting a year and a half custodial sentence. You'd put your hand up and say that's already served, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
And I take it that's part of your argument. Parole supervision has been categorized by this court as punishment.
Yes, Your Honor.
Punishment in itself. And if he wasn't credited, there would be some almost perverse incentive for him to get violated so he would get the credit.
Exactly, Your Honor.
Following me?
Yes, no, I think that's exactly right. And through our case law, I think also through the legislature, including through the statute I just mentioned, we have consistently treated parole and prison equivalently as part of an overall term. So as Your Honor was mentioning, any time that is spent in excess on either one has to result in credit. Otherwise, it is going to extend the overall term of incarceration beyond the term imposed. And like you mentioned, can really result in this absurd result where an individual can only get those credits if he is returned to prison. And just to go back to the statute 4-1.
Mr. Mason. Can I ask you to stay with the constitutional question for just a second?
Yes.
The crux of the argument is that the appellate division credited him and said that he's entitled to service credits on both indictments, and therefore he stayed in prison longer than he should have. And that lies at the core of your presentation. If this case were going to be sentenced today under CH, would the appellate division reach the same outcome?
CH is distinguishable, Your Honors, because it involves jail credit. So it does not, while obviously significant and is meant to serve some of the same purposes as prior service credit, it is grounded in court rules rather than the Constitution. So I think the appellate division was right in reaching that prior opinion. I don't think there's anything that would indicate that they would reach a contrary decision, even with CH. And in terms of, because this is something that was litigated years ago at this point, so this wasn't something that we briefed, although the Attorney General did mention it in their brief. But I think the presentation that the Attorney General presented shows that the appellate division likely would have reached the same result. The Attorney General cites three cases, including CH, which, like I mentioned, involved jail credit and not prior service credit, mentions an unpublished federal case, and then cites a single other published case that's on point from the Florida Supreme Court, which reached the same conclusion as the appellate division in Mr. Njango's prior appeal.
If CH were applied in a way that you've just argued it shouldn't be, if CH were read to mean that you get service credits, but not on each indictment, would you have a constitutional violation then?
So if Mr. Njango's prior appeal had not happened, Your Honor? And if Mr. Njango's prior appeal had been decided differently, which the appellate division ruled one way, this court declined to hear it, I would have to go back and just double check that there wouldn't have been a credit issue. But assuming that he had, that had not been ruled in his favor, he continued serving with it just aggregated toward the overall sentence, was released at 85% and didn't get any prior service credits beyond that, then there would not be that type of issue. If I understand your question correctly, Your Honor.
Yes.
But in this case, regardless of how that issue might have been resolved by a different panel, it was resolved that way. It was resolved in Mr. Njango's favor almost 4 years ago. He was released in May of 2017. As I mentioned, the appellate division ruled in his favor. The state sought certification from this court. It then sought reconsideration from this court. So I think while there is some discussion of the prior case and it is the reason why we do have these prior credits, it's not a separate issue that's before this court or something that I think the state can reach back 4 years and try to change.
But think about it in this way. To the extent that you're arguing there's a constitutional violation that needs to be remedied, if the original sentence was wrong, forget that it wasn't revisited, Is there still a constitutional violation?
I'm not quite sure I understand your Honor's question. My position would be to follow what the appellate division did, which is that he should have been awarded those credits. Whether the appellate division recognized it or not, it would still be improper in my view. It would still mean that he had excess credit, and following the same timeline, he still would have had those extra credits. And it all depends on that error being recognized and the credits ultimately being awarded.
Let's take away credits and try to make this a simpler question. Yes. Suppose someone had to do 8.5 years, mm-hmm. but instead mistakenly was held for 9.5 years.
Yes.
There is a constitutional violation there, correct?
Yes,
for which there should be some remedy. Now, what if after the fact it was discovered, no, that argument was flawed, never appealed, but it was flawed. The math was done wrong. Something was wrong. The person only did 8.5 years, even though you have an appellate division decision that says otherwise. Is there still a constitutional violation by the time that case comes before this court?
So if there is a subsequent opinion that, or subsequent information that comes forward and finds that the credit was not actually served, that there was no prior service credits, that could end up being an issue. I think it depends on how it ends up coming before the court, but if it's just another appellate panel that happens to reach that conclusion, I don't think that would be a way to reach back and change this. And I think the reason I'm having some difficulty is just the idea of being able to lose on appeal, not have your petition granted, have your motion for reconsideration denied, and then be able to bootstrap that issue again into the Supreme Court. And the state isn't really even arguing that this credit should be taken away. They're not arguing that the plea should be taken back, but to then use that as a way to say that credits just still should not be applied to your parole. If I lose a case and the Supreme Court denies the petition, I'm obviously not happy about that, but that doesn't mean if my client ends up in front of the Supreme Court in some different case, I can try to relitigate it.
I didn't mean to interrupt you. Did you have more of an answer?
No, go ahead, Justice Solomon.
Not meaning to jump around, but in response to the Chief's hypothetical, doesn't that undermine your fundamental fairness argument? And secondarily, as you're answering that, how much time did he actually spend in prison? Did he spend the 18 years he was sentenced to? Or did he, because I tried to calculate, I came up with 17 and a half. How much time did he actually spend?
So I think ultimately at the end of the day, it might make sense to remand the matter for a full calculation from the parole board, because I am trying to do the calculations myself, Your Honor. And there are some things that I think, you know, the state is in agreement with that is a little bit clearer. So the fact that he served a year, I think it was 7 months and 10 days after he should have been released. But I think that there is this additional chunk of a year and about like 1.3 years where his credits exceeded his parole term. And what makes this a little bit more complicated is that it's a NERA sentence. So the idea is in almost all cases, individuals on a NERA sentence are released once they hit 85%.
That's true. But what I'm trying to get at is for the purposes of determining double jeopardy, is it double jeopardy if he serves more than the 85% before he gets paroled? Or is it a double jeopardy issue if he serves more than the 18 years to which he was sentenced?
So I would submit that it's a violation if it's beyond the 85%, assuming that it is a typical NERA case. And I reached out to the parole board to try to figure this out. But in the vast, vast majority of cases, individuals have enough credit, so they release at that 85%. The reason why I think a remand might make sense to figure out, particularly that 1.3 years, is to ensure that Mr. Nujango had all of the prior service credits, the work credits, that would eat away that remaining 15%, such that he should have been released at the 85.
What I'm trying to get at is, I wanted you to discuss whether that 85% date is essentially a fixed date for double jeopardy purposes, or is the date we use the full 18 years? That's what I wanted you to get into.
I think the 85% would have to be the fixed date for it, assuming that those credits are in there, which is not as firm of an answer as I would like. But the real world answer for someone on NERA is that the 85% becomes their max date, at least for that term of imprisonment before they are released. And for that reason, because that if all these credits had been awarded, as Mr. Nujango had argued, that should have been when he was released. That was back in, I think it was October of 2015. He should have been released then and wasn't, because he should have been parole eligible. So for these types of cases, I think the 85% makes sense for double jeopardy. Although I would note that by the time he was actually released, he had credit that went beyond his maximum release date. So
what is his status now, Mr. Mason? Is he presently still serving mandatory parole?
He is, Your Honor. Yes, I checked with the parole board. Currently, if he does not receive additional credits or does not have these credits applied to it, he would complete his parole on May 10th, 2025.
But going back to the first question, which I probably shouldn't have asked two at one time, the Chief's hypothetical, does that not undermine your fundamental fairness argument?
I think the core of my fundamental fairness argument does depend on these prior rulings. We can only end up getting the additional credits if there are the prior rulings that recognize these errors. That's the only way you get these additional prior service credits. So in this case, the fundamental fairness argument, like in Williams, would go to the fact that Mr. Nujango did not get these prior service credits in a timely fashion because of a legal mistake on the part of the trial court.
Mr. Mason, I want to just come back to the hypo for a second. So imagine you come to the court and say, the appellate division a while back said, my client served 9.5 years. He should have only served 8.5 years. Fundamentally unfair. You need to change this NERA sentence in order to give him a remedy. And then drop a footnote in that brief and say, by the way, when the appellate division said that he served 9.5 years, we now know that they were wrong because he actually only served 8.5 years. What does that do to your fundamental fairness argument?
So I think in a situation where it is undisputed that the prior ruling was incorrect, I think that there would need to be a motion from the state, ideally, to correct it. I mean, if the idea is now that this prior award of credits is an illegal sentence and the sentence is still being served, then that should probably be the subject of a motion to remove those credits.
I take it your position is we granted certification on one issue. That's the one that you started at arguing. If the question of the correctness of the appellate division decision years ago, which we didn't grant cert on, is now going to be before the court, that should be rebriefed and re-argued.
Yes, Your Honor.
Because you're making an argument that service credits are different than jail credits. Whether or not that's a meaningful, I don't know. But that issue is not before us, correct?
That's correct, Your Honor. It's not before the court, so I think at a minimum there would need to be additional briefing on it. But I think that briefing even in itself would be inappropriate, just because, as you mentioned, it was decided years ago. There isn't. I think CH is clearly distinguishable because it is based on jail credits. You don't have that type of guarantee that you are going to get credit for time served that is grounded in the Constitution for jail credits. There is more of a policy consideration. There is more of, it's rule-based. So I don't think that CH would even provide a ground to reopen this issue now with briefing, but if the court were to disagree, I would ask for additional briefing because this is not something that was really discussed in the appellate division. It's not something that we briefed. Instead, I would ask that the court instead focus on the issue at hand, because we ultimately find that this credit did need to be awarded to the period of parole supervision. As I mentioned, it is required under the double jeopardy protections, but even beyond that is required under the statutes. I think I touched on this briefly, but under NJSA 30:4-123.65, that sets a strict limit on the amount of time that you can spend in custody altogether between parole and prison, and there is no exception. And I wanted to go back to that because that this court in State versus Rosado, which found that you had to get credit for time spent on parole towards your prison sentence, and I would note that was parole from a probationary jail term, which Justice Handler pointed out arguably resembles more like probation than parole. This court said that, and we've reached this conclusion, if the legislature disagrees, they should create an exception under this statute, the term limit statute, 123.65. The legislature didn't do that, but it did do that when it enacted parole supervision for life. But under that statute, NJSA 2C43-6.4, they made very clear that when you're calculating the overall term under this statute, you should treat parole supervision for life like a life sentence. And that effectively renders this term limit statute moot. You can serve parole forever, you can violate parole and go back on a parole violation for however many years, and we're not going to add it up. It doesn't really matter because this statute doesn't apply. So this court provided a framework for the legislature to create an exception to the term limit statute. The legislature did so in another statute, but did not do so in NERA. There is no exception to say that this does not apply. I think by the plain terms of the statute and the way that this court interpreted it in Rosado, it needs to apply to NERA parole, just like any other form of parole. In terms of consistency with NERA, I did also just want to emphasize that this is, again, not going to be a reduction of the overall term of custody, that this serves the purposes of NERA, and that already NERA allows part or theoretically even all of the custody term under parole supervision to be served in prison. And then in terms of the timing statute, which is discussed by the state, I think this is also significant. And I think that this provides a separate ground for relief, independent of the term limit statute and independent of double jeopardy, is the US Supreme Court's opinion in US versus Johnson, 529 US 53. In that case, the US Supreme Court was presented with the question of whether extra prior service credits can be applied to a non-custodial term of federal supervised release. And in answering that question, the court primarily focused on the timing provisions of when supervised release was supposed to begin. And in that case, the court found that you cannot apply those credits because federal supervised release can only begin when somebody is actually released from prison. The statute mentions it multiple times, saying that it commences on the day the person is released from imprisonment.
So what distinguishes that from what we're talking about here, the Nira parole? Why don't the same principles apply?
The difference here, Your Honor, is that the U.S. Supreme Court said that it would have reached a different result if the statute had instead referred to the end of the term of imprisonment or the end of the prison term. And that's the exact type of phrase that's used in Nira. For most defendants, unless you are also incarcerated on another offense, the term begins, quote, upon completion of the sentence of incarceration. The plain meaning of that term and the way that it's interpreted by the U.S. Supreme Court means the actual legal end of the sentence. It doesn't mean you have to get released that day. Ideally, that should be what happens, but it means when you should have been released. And those words are not interchangeable, contrary to the state and the attorney general's arguments. They mean different things as demonstrated by Johnson and as demonstrated by how the legislature has used those terms. To go back to the parole supervision for life, that statute uses the term after release from imprisonment. That makes it clear that the legislature was aware of this difference and that it chose different words for a different reason. It's also demonstrated by the Nira statute itself, because what it really establishes is two timelines. For an individual who is only in on the Nira offense, the term of parole supervision begins upon the completion of the sentence of incarceration. But for another individual who is still incarcerated on another offense, when the sentence of incarceration is completed, that individual is then released, or their parole begins upon release from incarceration. So the language in that section of Nira demonstrates two things. First, it demonstrates that those terms do not have the same meaning. Otherwise, the legislature wouldn't have used different words. It wouldn't have used all those words to draw that distinction. And the context that it's used regarding that second timeline is substantial because it shows what that means. It shows that somebody can complete their term of incarceration before they are released from incarceration. And the only way to interpret that is, as the US Supreme Court did, to mean that it is when somebody is legally completed their sentence. If you are held longer because of a legal or administrative error, that does not affect that date. It might affect when you are physically released, but it does not affect when you have completed your term of incarceration. So rather than actually supporting the state's position, the timing provisions in this case and the US Supreme Court's opinion in US versus Johnson actually demonstrate that credits not only can, but must be rewarded in this case. And then lastly, just to go back to the absurd results issue. As a policy matter, these credits should be awarded because that would be more consistent with the purposes of Nira. As discussed, this will not reduce the overall term of custody, and it will in fact favor and encourage individuals to abide by the conditions of their parole and lawfulness. It would be absurd to have a situation in which individuals who abide by their parole end up spending more time in prison, in custody, while individuals who violate and are returned to prison can theoretically spend less time in custody overall. It is also warranted as a matter of fundamental fairness, as discussed in this court's opinion in State versus Williams. It's an unusual situation, but ultimately it is a fundamentally unjust situation, particularly in the other cases. I agree that this is a procedurally unusual case, but the ruling in this case is going to go far beyond Mr. Majango, and most likely the individuals who are going to have these excess credits and going to be released on Nira parole are individuals who have received a lesser sentence, convicted of a lesser offense because they were deemed less culpable. And likely they're going to be individuals who have waited years to correct that legal error or to get relief. So for those individuals to then have their overall term of custody extended would be fundamentally unfair and provides another ground for relief in this case. So for all those reasons, Your Honors, we would respectfully request that this court reverse the appellate division's opinion and remand the matter for Mr. Majango to have his prior service credits applied to his term of Nira parole supervision. And unless Your Honors have any additional questions, I'll reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal if necessary.
Thank you, Mr. Mason.
Thank you.
Ms. Rosenkranz.
Okay, judges, this person is one of the luckiest people around. He has reaped the windfalls of missteps committed in resolving his two attempted murder indictments. Defendant was in prison an extra 19 months for one reason and one reason only, the appellate process. Defendant chose to appeal rather than move to vacate his guilty plea when the trial court told him that his 7+ years of prior service credit would only apply against his 10-year sentence. defendant must take the bitter with the sweet. He cannot retain the benefit of this very generous plea that basically reduced his sentencing exposure by at least half, and then spurn the full 8-year period of supervised parole. Nehra's goal is to protect the public from violent criminals. To do that, a Nehra sentence is composed of two distinct components: an 85% mandatory minimum term of incarceration and a separate mandatory period of supervised parole. The plain wording of Nehra commands that supervised parole begins after defendant completes his prison term. A different construction just tortures Nehra's words upon completion of the sentence of incarceration. In plain English, the phrase means what it says: when defendant gets out of prison. Also, it's an oxymoron that supervised parole can be served in prison. Defendant cannot be supervised by parole officers if he is in prison. Also, incarceration, which serves in incapacitation function, is different than supervised parole, which serves more of a deterrent and rehabilitative function. Reducing defendant's supervised parole would gut Nehra's goal to protect the public and have parole officers supervise and monitor violent offenders once they're released from prison. Also, it would thwart the intent of all parties to this plea, who all expected that defendant would serve a full 18-year Nehra sentence with the full 8-year period of parole supervision, nothing less. It is virtually certain that this trial court, who was concerned that this defendant posed a risk to the victim's safety, would have rejected this plea out of hand if he had known that defendant's overall sentence, including the 8-year period of parole supervision, would be so drastically reduced. Also, there was no double jeopardy violation. Defendant knew that his sentence had two parts. The trial judge couldn't have made it clearer. He knew that. Also, defendant received the full 7+ years of prior service credit. The quarrel was how to apply it. Also, defendant received a windfall when the appellate division applied the credit to both sentences. And yes, that is relevant to the double jeopardy analysis. The reasoning of CH that jail credits only apply to one of two consecutive sentences applies to prior service credits. Both prior service credits and jail credits deduct from defendant's sentence the time he has already been confined. Also, the state would like to propose a solution, because there are situations, thank goodness not precisely the one in this case, but where the defendant complains that he wasn't advised of some type of credit, prior service credit, jail credit, gap time credit, and therefore he should vacate his plea or that counsel was ineffective. So I would propose that if the defendant is so concerned about jail credits, and that is such a critical issue to his decision whether to take the plea or not, that issue must be decided before the plea hearing. And if he doesn't raise it then, it's waived. Thank you, Your Honors.
Ms. Rosenkranz, you're relying in a good measure on the plain language of the Nehra statute that you have emphasized for us just now and in your briefs as well. I take it you would agree, of course, that you can't read a statute in a way that would violate the Constitution, correct?
That's correct.
So if indeed there were a constitutional flaw here, the plain language argument would not be dispositive, right?
No, it wouldn't.
And if he indeed served more time than he should have, based on the rulings of the court, what then?
Well, Your Honor,
is that a constitutional violation that would need to be remedied?
not in this case, under NERA, because the sentence is composed of two distinct parts, the incarceration, and he knew he had to serve up to 85% of the base term, and he could have served a total up to 18 potentially, at least originally, and there's the separate component of the supervised parole.
So if it were beyond dispute that he had served more time than he should have in custody, in jail, as part of the sentence, wouldn't there be a need then to find a remedy that would require us to analyze the rest of the statute in a way that conforms to the Constitution?
Your Honor, in this case, no. I would analogize defendant's situation to a situation where a defendant appeals his conviction, it gets reversed on appeal, he's retried, and then he's acquitted during the retrial. At that point, there's no way he could get back that time, and there's no double jeopardy violation. This is what the defendant did here.
Are you saying that if there's no dispute that someone spent more than a year in custody beyond what they were required to, there's no leeway in terms of the imposition of the period of parole supervision? No remedy for the constitutional violation. We've got to abide by the plain language of the statute. Is that your position?
Yes, Your Honor, because the defendant knew. I think the double jeopardy issue centers on what this defendant thought he had to serve, what his sentence
consisted of. Ms. Rosenkranz, I want to follow up on the Chief Justice's question. So imagine, through clerical error, administrative error, on a NERA, we have a single sentence, NERA supervisory, the defendant winds up serving 5 additional years that he should never have served under NERA. For whatever reason, they didn't release him from prison. Sits 5 years. Your position is, if he served 5 years beyond the sentence he was supposed to serve, he gets no credit on his period of supervisory relief. I'm trying to understand your position. That's your position, correct?
Well, Your Honor, that is an extreme example.
I understand, but I'm trying to understand. It may be extreme, but that's your position. Am I mistaken?
Yes, it is.
And it's your position that fundamental fairness would not intercede, nor double jeopardy. It would just be tough luck. That's the way the cookie crumbles. That's your position?
Well, Your Honor, in the case where the defendant serves 5 extra years and he didn't initiate any appeals or anything.
Whatever.
Perhaps it's
1.9 here. You know, if it could be 1.9 here, it could be 5 in another case. Just want to understand your position. Your position is 5 extra years, nothing we can do about it. Serve your 5 extra years under supervised relief, correct?
Yes, pretty much. I would say so. Yes.
Please go on with your argument.
Your Honor, I believe that's about it, Your Honors. I pretty much covered it. Everything. I believe that United States versus Johnson is very analogous. It's reasoning why that things are proper or properly done in this case. And I also like to emphasize, you know, the defendant could have moved to vacate this plea, and he could have avoided this whole situation of spending extra time in jail and prison if he had done that. But he wanted to retain the benefit of this very generous plea, where he basically reduced his sentencing exposure by half, at least. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Kamisiak.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. I would like to focus on four main points this morning. And the first point is really at the heart of this case. And it's picking up on what the Chief Justice had brought up with Mr. Mason. And that is the issue of the prior appellate division ruling that gave the double jail credit. And the Attorney General would submit that that issue absolutely is before the court. And here is why. The question presented by the defendant in this case contemplates that there was wrongful incarceration. If that is not actually the case, then there's no need for a remedy because there was no violation to begin with. And I wanted to lay out the timeline because I know Justice Solomon had also asked how much time did this defendant actually serve. And I think in laying out that timeline, it's important to note that the appellate division's decision in 2017 effectively would have retroactively allowed the defendant out at the date of the resentencing, which was October 1st, 2015. And at that point, this defendant had served a total of 9 years and 2 months in jail, if my calculations were correct. And he ended up serving that the period he's complaining about is an extra 1 year and 7 months for a total of just under 11 years. Now, if the jail credit had properly been applied to the aggregate 18-year nearer sentence, which is what everyone had contemplated in this case, that this was going to be an aggregate 18-year nearer sentence, the defendant would have to serve 15 years, 3 months, and 18 days in jail. And by my calculations, he would still be serving that sentence today and even through the end, towards the end of this year. So that is a fundamental part of this case. The fact that in the Attorney General's view, there is no wrongful incarceration. Yeah.
So Ms. Kamisiak, I think I understand your position, mm-hmm. but it requires us to collaterally attack a prior appellate division opinion that we denied certification on, correct? I mean, in order to get where you want us to go, we got to go back and say the case that we didn't take, we should have taken, and we should have overruled. Am I mistaken?
No, that's correct, Your Honor. And I would note that it's well established that when this court or the United States Supreme Court denies certification, that is not a ruling on the merits. So I think that's very critical here. This court actually has never on the merits said that the appellate division's unpublished opinion here was correct. And the defendant—
But we granted certification, and I understand your argument. We granted certification, mm-hmm. and I you quoted it correctly, where the prior service credits for time that a person was wrongfully imprisoned, mm-hmm. and under the terms wrongfully imprisoned, you want to go back and say the appellate division 4 years ago got it wrong, he wasn't wrongfully imprisoned, mm-hmm. and now you want us to revisit CH and ask that jail credits be compared to service credits. I'm raising all that. Can we really decide that issue based upon how we granted cert and based upon the briefing? Does the defendant even have notice on which to be arguing this point?
Well, I think to the extent this court feels that the briefing would not have been sufficient, the court certainly can request supplemental briefing, and the Attorney General would be happy to do that, because to just say that the appellate division's unpublished decision, which conflicts with CH, conflicts with the 11th Circuit case that we cited in our brief, that's really right on point, and extends North Carolina v. Pierce so far beyond what North Carolina v. Pierce was about, we shouldn't just compound the injustice of the double credit and just say, well, we're stuck with that ruling when this court.
So I understand the argument you're making with respect to this mm-hmm. defendant, but there also is a larger issue. Forget about this defendant. mm-hmm. and a case where, let's say a person clearly served 5 years more than he should have or she should have served. Mm-hmm. Is it your position, as argued by the state, that there could be no credit on the supervisory relief release if the person served mistakenly 5 extra years? Do you hold to that position, the position yes. advanced by the state?
Yes, Your Honor. And really, number one,
that's an important issue that mm-hmm. that if we go back and revisit that appellate division case, we're not going to be really addressing that here, are we?
Perhaps not, Your Honor, but I would just note that NERA has been in effect, I believe, since 1997, and this is the first time that we're ever, that this issue is even arising, and it took such an unusual series of events to even get here, starting with the fact that the defendant got the benefit of concurrent sentences in his plea agreement when he attacked his estranged wife while he was out on bail for attacking his mother-in-law and complained about the benefit of concurrent sentences. And that's how this whole snowball effect happened. So we don't really envision that hypothetical really arising, but to the extent it does, that could be addressed in an appropriate case. But yes, I do agree with the state that the period of parole supervision is a separate component of the sentence. And Justice LaVecchia was picking up on this before in the United States v. Johnson case, which we discussed extensively in our brief. In that case, the defendant served an extra 2.5 years in jail. And I would say in terms of the equities, in that case, the equities are much more in favor of the defendant than in this case, where in Johnson, the conviction was actually vacated because based on a later United States Supreme Court case, the defendant's conduct of possessing a gun during a drug offense didn't rise to the level of what the U.S. Supreme Court said you had to actually brandish or somehow use the gun. But here we don't have that situation. We don't have a defendant getting, you know, any benefit or getting this. He wasn't innocent of any of these crimes. So in Johnson, the United States Supreme Court said essentially that unfortunately there was no remedy, and that holds true here as well. And the equities are really not in the defendant's favor to the extent defendant continues to say that this is an injustice and fundamental fairness. We have to go back to the underlying appellate division decision. The second point I wanted to make was about the difference between regular parole and NERA parole. And they're fundamentally different. And in fact, in Friedman, this court said unique and radically different. And I just wanted to address, Mr. Mason had cited NJSA 30:4-123.65. And I would just note that that provision really deals with regular parole. And that's the provision that says essentially that a non-NERA defendant can't serve more than the term specified in the original sentence. But in Johnson, and that's R. Johnson, State v. Johnson, 182 NJ 232, 2005, this court actually distinguished that and said that's a non-NERA defendant, but a NERA defendant, should they violate parole and be reincarcerated, the result may be that he or she will serve more time than the original term of the sentence. So there's a fundamental difference between regular parole and NERA parole.
Are you suggesting that parole, which we have declared in cases, and the U.S. Supreme Court has declared in cases to be punishment, that NERA parole is not punishment under the Constitution? No, you're not arguing that, are you?
I am not, Your Honor, and that actually jumps ahead to my fourth point, but I can go there now. We're certainly not suggesting that. The case law is clear that NERA parole supervision is punitive. The defendant is in the custody of the commissioner of the Department of Corrections. And this court has even said if a defendant is not told about the parole supervision, that may be a basis to withdraw the plea. So we are not saying that, but our position is that is not in any way dispositive of the double jeopardy issue. And here's why. Defendant, again, is relying on North Carolina v. Pierce, but North Carolina v. Pierce is completely different. In North Carolina v. Pierce, the companion defendant Rice served time on his convictions. They were later vacated and he was retried and resentenced. And the state of Alabama, I believe it was, refused to give him any credit against his new sentence for the time he had actually spent in jail prior to the appeal and the vacating of his convictions. And that is what Pierce spoke to on that issue, that he had to get that credit. Pierce nowhere mentions this, you know, any period of parole supervision like what we have here in NERA. And we should not extend Pierce beyond that limited factual context, particularly where we know from the United States v. Johnson decision, as we've been discussing, that Johnson expressly rejects this view that prison time and supervised release in the federal system are interchangeable. The United States Supreme Court could not have been more clear that they are not interchangeable. So we should not assume that the United States Supreme Court would extend Pierce beyond what Pierce.
Can I ask you a question just about the statute, not even getting to the constitutional issue. So a person is given a 13-year, let's say, NERA sentence, or the NERA portion is going to be 13 years, and the supervisory release is 5 years. So that would be an 18-year sentence, yes? Okay, now I'm going to go back to my example again. Okay, instead of getting out in 13 years, everyone's asleep at parole, and he's now in jail for 18 years. Okay, adding the 5 year supervisory above the is going to exceed the statutory limit, no?
I want to go back just to correct my answer. You asked if I agree that the total is 18 years, and I would qualify that and say that the we don't add those two together because
Okay, go ahead. I didn't mean to interrupt you.
That's okay. Thank you, Your Honor. The legislature made them separate and distinct components of the sentence. So the 13 years is the period of incarceration. Nope. And then the 5 years is a separate and distinct component. So even if the defendant does additional time on the custodial piece, the parole supervisory period is a distinct component of the sentence.
So let's say the person, you heard this earlier, a hypothetical I've given, starts out on supervisory parole and violates it. And he's given 5 years. So he's served five extra years. And you're telling us he wouldn't get any credit for the 5 years that he shouldn't have served on prison, gets no credit towards the five additional years that he's serving because he was violated on his supervisory release. That's your argument?
Yes, Your Honor. I would just note that the fact that if they violate, they don't necessarily, they're not necessarily returned to custody. And I think that's an important point.
But assume that he is or she is. I'm just trying to understand your argument. If he or she is returned to incarceration and is serving, let's say, 5 years on the supervisory instead of being released, you're saying there's no credit given against the 5 years he or she shouldn't have served. Your position, correct?
Yes, I would just qualify it slightly because I think that if they violate, so taking aside, let's say there's no violation, if they're just on supervised release and they don't violate, I 100% agree that they don't get any credit that's not deducted from the period of supervised release. If they violate, that may be a different question. I would say, I think it's an open question for the parole board. And I say that because I looked into and I couldn't find any case law as to whether if they violate, I know Mr. Mason has argued in his brief and today that there's this perverse incentive that if he violates, he will get that credit returned to him when he goes into jail. I'm not sure that's necessarily the case, that really wasn't briefed in this case. I wasn't able to find any case law on it.
Ms. Kaminsiak, when that happens, when somebody violates during the mandatory period of parole and the person is going to be returned to custody for an additional period of incarceration, is there an actual resentencing proceeding that takes place at that point to determine how much time the individual must now serve?
I don't believe so, Your Honor, because I think it's handled by the parole board. I think it's handled by the parole board in the ordinary course, is my
understanding. Does it follow the literal language of the statute that someone is returned and completes the entire period of the sentence, even if all total, the amount of time already spent on mandatory parole plus the remainder of the original sentence exceeds what the original sentence could have been?
Right. I think that the actual language is important, and it's NJSA 30:4-123.51B. And that's the part that's referenced in the last clause of subsection C that we're dealing with here.
Mm-hmm.
Essentially what it says is that they're in release status, but they have the authority to revoke the person's release status and return the person to custody for the remainder of the term or until it is determined in accordance with regulations that they're again eligible for release. So it's not necessarily the case that they're returned for the entire time. That's the outer limit is the way
that's to be determined, I guess.
Yes, absolutely, Your Honor.
So your argument, as I understand it, is that you have the period of incarceration. The individual defendant is then released for the mandatory period of parole, and the two stand apart under the legislative choice to impose two forms of punishment, even though each has attributes of a custodial flavor. Is that correct?
Yes. Yes.
Let me ask you this. I mean, because under the double jeopardy analysis and argument that we're hearing, part of it is premised on the fact that because the second piece, the mandatory period of parole, constitutes punishment, and no one disputes that it's not punishment, parole is considered punishment, that there must be the service credit applied to that period. Would that, if that is accepted at face value, forget the parole statute argument, does that mean if there were service credits to be applied, they would have to apply to a period of community service that was also imposed as an additional period of punishment on a conviction? I mean, that would be punishment, correct? So must that be day-for-day credit for that as well?
It seems that would be the logical and next step of the defendant's argument, assuming that, you know, the double jeopardy, the court found a double jeopardy violation. That would seem to be the next logical step.
Well, what would be the principled way of limiting it?
I'm not sure, Your Honor, and I think that's the problem. In the Attorney General's view, the principled way of limiting it is to view the incarceration and the parole supervision as separate and distinct. And we have to keep in mind, yes, the defendant, when they're on supervised release, is in the legal custody of the Department of Corrections, but if they don't violate, they're not returned to custody. So I think that's an important thing to keep in mind. What the
Ms. Kamisiak, by dividing things so cleanly, you're effectively saying to a defendant who has been held longer, undisputedly longer than he should have, that there is no remedy for that violation. Is that right?
Yes, Your Honor, and I would just say that there's many scenarios in the law where, unfortunately, putting this case aside, you know, things happen, appeals take time, as the state said, you know, people can be acquitted where they do serve extra time in jail and there is no remedy. But
this is different from an acquittal. Here you have a finding of guilt, you have a plea, and you have a sentence that was imposed that was violated. Does the defendant have the right to bring a civil suit and seek money damages?
Perhaps they could, but I'm not really sure what the basis would be unless there was any kind of, you know, bad faith or something going on. I mean, essentially the fact that a mistake was made, I'm not sure that that would be enough for a civil suit. But I mean, as I said before, this is the first time we're hearing of this type of situation happening, and hopefully that's a testament to the fact that such an egregious mistake would not happen of someone by a clerical error serving, you know, extra years in jail. If that were to happen, that could be addressed in that case, but that is certainly not the situation that we have here, where we have this defendant, you know, again, as I said, starting with this premise that he wanted consecutive sentences, and then it's snowballing from there. So that would be the Attorney General's position.
Other questions, anyone? Is there anything you'd like to add, Ms. Kamisiak?
I just wanted to very briefly touch on the statutory interpretation argument that Mr. Mason had raised before. And he essentially was arguing that there's like these two different timeframes as to when near parole supervision would start. One would be if they're not serving another sentence, and then the other would be if they are serving another sentence. And I would just say that this court made clear in the Friedman case that we don't look at, you know, just one piece of the statute and read it that way. We have to read the statute as a whole. And I think the last part of the statute in this case really makes clear that parole supervision starts when the person is actually released from incarceration. And I would just quote from the statute: during the term of parole supervision, the defendant shall remain in release status in the community in the legal custody of the commissioner of the Department of Corrections and shall be supervised by the state parole board as if on parole. So essentially, you cannot be supervised as if you're on parole when you are still incarcerated. So to the extent there was any ambiguity, which we submit there was not, that really clears it up. And this court already recognized in Friedman that the whole purpose of these mandatory fixed periods of parole supervision was to protect the public from the risk of release by the most violent offenders being reintegrated back into the community. And I would just sum up and say that the successor plea agreement in this case called for the 18 years near a sentence. The defendant really got a windfall by not serving that full term. And while that is an injustice that can't be remedied at this stage, that doesn't mean that the injustice should be compounded by allowing the defendant to apply these purported unused credits to reduce his mandatory period of parole supervision in this case. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. Mr. Mason, rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor. I wanted to make
Can I ask you to help with something at the outset? We understand that you have a ruling at the appellate division level in your favor and have every right to say, I don't want to relitigate that. But you're here advancing a different argument now that's premised on a constitutional violation. Can that argument be based on a mistake? And assume, just for the purpose of this question, that the ruling was a mistake, please.
So I think that going back and looking at the propriety of the prior ruling is improper as in general. And what I was thinking about when the state was talking about this is this going to happen every single time we have a case like this? Because we have other clients that are in this similar situation where, you know, they had consecutive sentences, and then on appeal, one of the consecutive sentences was reversed, the other one wasn't. So that person ended up spending more time in prison. If this court doesn't grant certification, that issue is not disturbed, it's unpublished. Is that then going to be relitigated if he ends up in front of this court arguing how his credit should be applied? Do we go back and then say, well, was the reversal of that consecutive sentence really appropriate? I think maybe we would have a different situation if the state had filed a motion to correct an illegal sentence, if there was a clear case that was directly on point saying that there was some type of mistake, maybe we would be in a different situation, but we don't even have that here. So I don't think that the propriety of the prior appellate division opinion is relevant, at least for this consideration. Although I would request, you know, if this court disagrees, that there be additional briefing on it, because this has not been an issue that has been addressed. If that didn't address your question fully, Your Honor, I can address it a little bit more.
No, it did.
Okay.
It did. And I understand your request at the end of it as well. Thank you.
Thank you. In terms of the other issues I wanted to address, I did want to address some questions that Justice LaVecchia raised about how revocation hearings happen and how the credits are applied. So one of the main differences between parole and probation is that this is really just an administrative proceeding. If they are switched from custody on parole, from custody to prison, and there's a much more deferential standard on review because it's an administrative determination. In terms of how the jail credits or prior service credits might be awarded if a person violates and is returned, I reached out to the parole board. It seems like this has not been a situation that they have directly addressed, but they did point me to two situations, an unpublished appellate division case and another situation in which jail credits were applied when somebody violated their near parole and were returned. And as I discussed before, jail credits are less protective than prior service credits. They are not constitutionally grounded. So I think if anything, you know, might be a little bit of an open question, at least when it would happen. But based on that precedent from the parole board, and just based on the plain text of the double jeopardy protections, that would also extend to prior service credits. The administrative nature of it is also something I wanted to emphasize, because the state and the attorney general are trying to draw a distinction between the two forms of parole, you know, non-NERA versus NERA. And while there is case law talking about NERA parole being unique, that's really only talking about this additional term that's tacked on. The actual substance of each of them really is not distinguishable. You are in custody, in the custody of the Department of Corrections for the full time for both forms of parole. You are supervised by the parole board. You have essentially the same conditions, including a reduced expectation of privacy. You can be frisked at any time. You can have your home or car searched based on reasonable suspicion. There really is no distinction that can be drawn. And the distinctions that the state is trying to draw basically are asking you to rewrite two statutes and a Supreme Court case. And the state is asking you to create an exception to the term limit statute, 3123.65, to say that it doesn't apply to NERA. Nothing from that statute says that. The legislature, when it wants to create an exception, has, and it has been in this case. It wants to completely rewrite the two timelines to condense them. It wants to cut out 56 words to say, you know what, when the legislature used all these words and they used different words, they actually just meant, no matter what, this only starts when you're released from imprisonment. That's not what we do for statutory interpretation, and it's not what can happen now. They're also asking this court to arbitrarily limit Pierce. Pierce doesn't say this only applies to prison. It says that you have to deduct time served no matter, or whatever, you have to subtract it from whatever new sentence is imposed. And Justice Levecchia, I don't think that would extend to if you're doing community service or probation or anything like that. I would draw the line at least on custodial sentences, which is what parole is and how it's always been recognized.
And your basis for doing that?
For custody, Your Honor?
So your basis for doing that, limiting it to custodial sentences?
But I think when we're talking about subtracting, they have to, I think logically have to be of a similar kind. And I think you have to still look at the legislation in order to determine what that is. So if we're looking at the different purposes and different levels of custody, it makes sense that you would only subtract it for the most part if you are dealing with similar things.
And is that part of your analysis of the resolution of the double jeopardy remedy required, or are you melding in part your interpretation of statutes in that response?
So as part of my double jeopardy argument, I think really at the core of it is the fact that we have always treated parole and prison as legal equivalents, the fact that you do have all of these limitations that are still placed on parolees and prisoners. And I do think it's important in this case, and this court has previously applied parole toward prison terms, but I think it's really important to emphasize that we're dealing with the opposite in this case, where we are asking to apply credit for the more invasive and less desirable form of custody, extra time spent in prison, to be applied to the less controlling situation of custody on parole. So I think that is a key part of it. And it is a key part of a lot of this, because the legislation, the case law, I think everything in this case weighs in favor of giving the one remedy that the US Supreme Court has identified. We don't need to look hard for it. If we can give the time back, then we have to do it. It is not only an option, it is a mandate under the Constitution. So for that reason and the other reasons discussed, we would respectfully request that this court reverse the appellate opinion and remand the matter for Mr. Njango to receive his credits. And alternatively, if we do reach that prior appellate opinion, we would respect additional briefing.
Thank you to all counsel. Thank you for the fine argument.